Hello, welcome to the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 4th, 2025. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic, and so we begin with reading the list of names in the obituaries. Pedro Alvarez, Charles Arthur Britton, Elizabeth Murphy Burns, Thomas Robert Crowley, Mikkel Day Denning, Sonia May Dittner, Ronald Anthony Felix, Margaret E. Johnson, known as Margot, Sharon Ray Lopez, Catherine Meggs Morales, known as Kit, Wendell Montandon, Richard Neuheisel, known as Dick, Barbara Ann Plone, Marguerite Catherine Rattle, John Lawrence Smith, known as Larry, Antonio V. Talabas, Melvin Warner Thompson, and Harry Lee Walter. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences and sympathies to the friends and families of the individuals listed in today's obituaries. We have two articles now from the economy section, which is where we've shifted over to. The first one, written by Russ Wiles, Arizona workers wait after UPS says it will lay off 20,000. UPS employees in Arizona face layoffs as the global shipping company announced plans to reduce its overall workforce by 20,000 positions, citing a changing trade environment amid the tariff uncertainty. The company did not specify how many Arizona positions would be cut. Local workforce reductions and office closures won't be announced until after affected individuals are notified, according to a spokeswoman. The overall reduction equates to about 4% of UPS's global employee count of 490,000 employees. The shipping company reported 6,600 Arizona workers as of the Republic 100 statewide employment report, which was published last September. If Arizona's headcount is trimmed by 4%, that would equal roughly 265 layoffs. UPS ranked as the 29th largest non-governmental employer in Arizona last year, down from 25th place in 2023, when the company counted 7,227 workers in the state. UPS also announced a workforce reduction of 14,000 positions in 2024, primarily involving managers. The latest layoff warning came as UPS announced on April 29th that its first quarter revenue dropped 0.7%, down to just $21.55 billion, as corporate executives cited, quote, current macroeconomic uncertainty and a changing trade environment, unquote, as President Donald Trump pushes for higher tariffs on imports. The company's net income rose 6.6% to $1.19 billion during the January through March stretch. The layoff announcement comes amid further signs of economic weakness. And that was Arizona workers wait after UPS says it will lay off 20,000. Our other article from the Arizona Economy section was written by Karina Vanek for the Arizona Republic, and it's entitled Signs to Watch For Amid Economic Worries. Here's what she wrote. Tariffs, inflation, and a volatile stock market have left people feeling extra cautious about their finances, as widespread news of U.S. government layoffs have some people afraid for their jobs. According to a survey conducted by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, more than 70% of Americans have felt either cautious or uncertain about their financial situation over the past 12 months. About 27% of respondents said they either started saving money or had increased their savings rate in that time. Some early warning signs seem to be subtly showing, some Arizona business leaders said. But right now, concerns are still mild, not major. Other Arizona business owners said while they do worry over economic uncertainty, their businesses are successful and are still able to grow. Valley economist Jim Rounds from Rounds Consulting Group and Danny Court from Elliott D. Pollock & Company provided some everyday indicators that they watch that could point to a softening in the economy. Less foot traffic or less money spent in restaurants can indicate that people have less discretionary money to spend. In Arizona, restaurants have seen slower growth this year than forecast, according to Steve Chukri, who is president and CEO of the Arizona Restaurant Association. In general, Arizona restaurants see a pullback in spending every summer after their high season, which includes the Waste Management Phoenix Open and spring training. But this year, even in the busier season, growth was a little slower than the target. Year over year, Arizona restaurants are seeing growth of about 2.8%. Chukri said that is slightly below the target of 3% or 4% growth. Slowing sales could mean patrons are foregoing buying drinks or dessert when they dine out. Foot traffic generally slows after Mother's Day, which is traditionally the biggest day of the year for restaurants. Chukri said, quote, "It's not major, it's mild, but there is a softening," unquote. He added that restaurants are still competitive with grocery stores, meaning that people still see restaurants as a viable alternative to cooking at home. But the industry is still forecast to remain strong in Arizona this year, with it expected to hit almost $23 billion in sales in 2025. Now, casual and fast casual restaurants are usually the first to see a decline. People who eat at fine dining establishments can usually afford to weather an economic downturn, he said, but people who frequent more casual restaurants might choose to eat at home instead. For some Phoenix area fast casual restaurants, looking at the possibility of a downturn has meant adding some options to the menu to cater to customers looking to spend a little less. Michael Nelson, CEO of Mr. Pickle's Sandwich Shops, wrote in an email, quote, "While we have not seen a decline in transactions, we have noticed our fans have reduced their average spend per visit. This is most notable in the slight reduction in the add-on of drinks, chips, and deli salads," unquote. Now, Mr. Pickle's always offered whole and half sandwiches, but fans of the brand told the company they would like a mid-size option. So the company rolled out the Sammy, a smaller sandwich that might be a little more satisfying than the half-size and a little lighter on the price point than a full-size sandwich. Nelson said, quote, "Very visually, it looks like our whole sandwich, just a few bites smaller. And together with chips, the free cookie, and a drink, it makes the perfect meal. Based on its success in April 2025, we also launched the $7.99 Sammy Combo Promotion, which offers guests an attractive price point for an entire meal under $10, unquote. Dan Chowon, founder and CEO of Arizona-based chicken restaurant Sneaky Bird, said his business has not seen any shifts in customer behavior, but he does expect changes if household discretionary income is affected by the shaky economy. In an email, Chowon said, quote, "Each community we have a presence in will have their own threshold of tolerance and view of enjoying things like dining out or taking in an event. I also believe our guests want to support their favorite restaurants, and we are doing everything we can with offering strong value and craveable new items to entice them to come in," unquote. Sneaky Bird also added a new menu item at a lower price point. He said, quote, "We wanted to be proactive in our pricing, no matter the market, to stay competitive without sacrificing on quality. As such, on April 21st, we introduced sliders to our menu. We are utilizing our perfectly crunchy, juicy, oven-grilled tenders as the base for the new menu offerings, pairing them with a smaller version of our soft, lightly sweet, rich brioche bread, and the guest choice of several spectacular dry rubs and sauces, which results in several dozen flavor combinations, unquote. Well, if consumers fear that they will have less discretionary income to spend, they will likely cut back on luxury goods or services, like hairstyling, new clothes, beauty products, and other splurges. However, Dr. Ashley Milheiser, who is a naturopathic doctor and owns Real Results Medical and Aesthetics, said she has not seen consumers pulling back on spending. Milheiser offers medical treatments and aesthetic services like hair restoration, weight loss, body contouring, injectables, and other treatments. She opened her first office in 2023 and a second location this year. She said, quote, "Yes, it is a luxury, but people are reorganizing and prioritizing, and getting full medical care is still a priority for them. We see a lot of repeat customers and a lot of referrals," unquote. Some of her most popular aesthetic treatments are hair restoration and body contouring. She recently launched an aesthetics membership aimed at making treatments more affordable for returning customers. So far, she said, she continues to see month-over-month growth, and her businesses are staying busy. She said of worries about the economy, quote, "Any business owner is going to have concerns. I try to remove myself from that. Everyone's experience is individual. I'm trying to stay very grounded in what's real, and what's real is growth," unquote. Now, housing can be a complicated issue to judge when it comes to economic indicators. High interest rates have suppressed home buying for years, so houses stay on the market longer, and that might not be a clear indication. Cindy Reddy, who is president of the Arizona Association of Realtors, said there is still a shortage of homes available on the market at all price points, but slightly more available are this year than at the same time last year. In March 2024, about 35,000 homes were on the market, compared with about 45,000 homes in March of 2025. While there was an increase, the market has stayed pretty level. Arizona's real estate outlook is steadier than the national market, she said, which has tended down. Quote, "If a house is in a really amazing location and doesn't need any work, sellers can still push the market. But what happened is sellers pushed the market too high, and now they're having to adjust their prices," unquote. Reddy said the Phoenix market now is neither a seller's market nor a buyer's market, but houses are available to buyers without the bombardment of competition that was common a few years ago. She said, quote, "I tell buyers not to be afraid to be out there looking. Many times sellers are willing to give concessions, like money toward closing costs that can be used to buy down an interest rate," unquote. Now, interest rates remain high, she said, which can be discouraging for buyers who cannot afford to pay in all cash. If interest rates were to drop, buyers would likely be more active in the Phoenix market and others around the country. For homes that are considered luxury homes, either because of their price point or amenities, move-in ready homes that are priced at the lower end of luxury at about $1.5 million still tend to sell quickly, she said. Now, sales and discounts on travel can indicate people have less discretionary income to spend on vacations or other experiences. Companies can offer discounts or incentives to customers to try to entice them to buy trips or vacations. Other expensive purchases, like appliances or cars, could also see discounts or sales, but some of that could be offset by tariffs. Publicly traded airlines are already forecasting a change, with Southwest Airlines, Delta, and American Airlines all cutting their revenue projections for the first quarter of the year. An indicator that might not be very visible in everyday life, but is a strong metric of growth, is the monthly jobs report from the U.S. Department of Labor. Falling job creation can be a major indicator of a slowing economy. If it falls below 100,000, that means things are very weak, Rounds said. For comparison, in March, the country added 228,000 new jobs, according to the report. And that was Corina Vanek's article, Signs to Watch For Amid Economic Worries. Well, we're coming up on 16 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the sports section. The cover story from the front page of the sports section was written by Logan Stanley for the Arizona Republic, and it's entitled Records on the Rise for Track and Field in Arizona. Records are meant to be broken. That's how the saying goes, right? Well, the athletes in Arizona have taken this saying and jumped, hurdled, thrown, and run with it, especially in the sport of track and field. Just since the 2023 season, 13 state records have been set. It's been an incredible amount of record-breaking performances in such a limited time, and it's also an illustration of the rise in the sport, both in Arizona and on a national scale. This rise was showcased on a warm May 11th night last year in Mesa when Gilbert's Vance Nilsson set the United States High School National Record in the 300-meter hurdles, becoming the first prep athlete to run under 35 seconds for that event. So here are three athletes who have been part of the record rise in Arizona. First off, Hayden Gorovitz from Phoenix Desert Vista in the javelin in 2023. Gorovitz was the first athlete to kick off this record run back in March of 2023. At a local meet, the Ridge Invite in Glendale, Gorovitz uncorked a throw of 209 feet 6 inches, which set the Arizona State record in the javelin. Gorovitz took down the old record of 204 feet set by Tempe Marcos Denise's Carlin Nascent in 2019. A few weeks later that season, at the Willie Williams Classic down in Tucson, Gorovitz made history. Against a whole field of collegians, Gorovitz, who was then a junior in high school, shocked the crowd when he threw 221 feet 8 inches. The throw was epic on many levels. It was the first time a high school athlete from Arizona had gone over 220 feet. Nascent hit 215 feet 3 inches and 205 feet 2 inches in 2018, but those marks came after he graduated from high school. For most of the season, Gorovitz was ranked number one in the country. It wasn't until one of the final meets of the season, the Nike Outdoor Nationals, that an athlete from Washington surpassed him. Gorovitz ended the season number two in the event. And after his record-breaking season, Gorovitz earned a scholarship to Nebraska, one of the top schools in the NCAA for the javelin. He missed his senior year due to injury, so there was no encore. But it was a special season from Gorovitz that began it all. Gorovitz established the first of seven state records set in 2023 season, including four broken within 70 minutes of each other at the Arcadia Invitational in California during one of the most special nights in track and field in Arizona prep history. Next up, Vance Nilsson from Gilbert in the hurdles of 2024. It was always going to be hard to top the 2023 season, with records falling left and right, and for a while it seemed that 2024 was going to slow down. And then came Gilbert senior Vance Nilsson. He began to turn things on in the second meet, the Devon Allen Invitational in Phoenix in early March. Nilsson broke a meet record held by the event's namesake Allen, the former Brophy prep star who was in attendance. He won both the hurdle races at the Nike Chandler Rotary Invitational and the Arcadia Invitational in a span of 2 weeks, almost breaking the state record in the 300-meter hurdles at Arcadia. And the following week, that came Nilsson's first record of the season, when he easily took down the 300 hurdles record at a relatively low-key meet called the Westwood Hohokam Invite, held in Mesa in early April. Nilsson ran 35.67 seconds to beat Brophy Prep's Bobby Grant's time of 36.24. And then he went 35 seconds and 50 hundredths of a second at the Northeast Valley Championships before the state championships. And at the Division I meet, Nilsson ran 13.39 to break Allen's record in the 110-meter hurdles. A few hours later, Nilsson ran 35.05 to lower his state record in the 300 hurdles, also recording the second fastest time in U.S. history for the event. And the next week, at the AIA Championships, Nilsson ran 34.83 seconds to destroy the national record of 35.02. And a week later, Nilsson committed to Florida, the three-time defending NCAA champions. He then switched to the 400-meter hurdles, narrowly missing the final at the U.S. Olympic track and field trials. Nilsson ended his year in August by winning the Under 20 World Athletics Championship in the 400-meter hurdles in 49.26 seconds, almost setting his second high school national record and capping off one of the best single seasons ever from an Arizona athlete. Well, following a national record is a tall task, but Phoenix Country Day School senior Sam Novak has worked to keep Arizona in the national spotlight with his incredible effort in the pole vault this season. Now, the history of the pole vault is rich in Arizona, as Phoenix North's Jim Brewer, back in the 1950s, was the first high schooler to clear 14 and 15 feet. He set national records then. Tollison's Nick Hisong continued that legacy, setting the state record in 1990, before becoming an NCAA champion at Arizona State University and winning the gold medal at the 2000 Olympics. Hisong's fingerprints are on the record books, and now Novak trains at the center run by Hisong, called Risen Performance. Novak started 2025 by hitting 17 feet 2 inches at an indoor meet in Nevada in January. That was a sign of what was to come. A month later in New Mexico, Novak cleared 17 6.5 inches to come within a half inch of tying the state record. Novak again hit 17 6.5 inches at the New Balance Nationals indoor in March to place second before beginning his outdoor season with 17 feet 1.75 inches. And then, at the top of the mountain invite held in Mesa on April 15th, Novak went over 17 feet 8 inches. It broke the record of 17 feet 7 inches that was set by Surprise Valley Vista's Cole Riddle back in 2017. Now the season is still going on, so Novak has time to hit his goal of 18 feet. At the moment, Novak is ranked number 3 in the country. Well, what does this all mean? You see, these athletes aren't the only ones to excel on a national scale. Here are the other athletes to finish with a top 10. Ranking in the country since 2023, Tyler Matthews from Red Mountain in the 800 meters, Brennan McHenry from Brophy Prep in the long jump, Zach Bingham from Highland in the pole vault, Gabriela Garcia from Basha in javelin, Sarah Price from Williams Field in the 100-300-meter hurdles, Catherine Littlewood from Queen Creek in the long jump, Taylor Searle from ALA Queen Creek in the pole vault, Corey Martin from Hamilton in the 100 hurdles, Rebecca Jade Garrett from North Canyon in the 100 hurdles, Annalise Taylor from Canyon View in the 300 hurdles, Tracy White, ALA Anthem South from the triple jump, Zelaya Dupree from Copper Canyon in the triple jump. This season, there are currently 7 athletes ranked in the top 10. There's no denying that the sport of track and field in Arizona is quickly trending upward. Recently, the Arizona Republic had a one-on-one interview with Devin Allen, who became an NCAA champion hurdler at Oregon and a 2-time Olympian after he graduated from Brophy. Allen told the Republic, quote, "Selfishly, I think Arizona has some of the best track in the country. We don't have indoors, so we don't get that opportunity to showcase early on in the season. A lot of East Coast times early in the year are fast because they got indoor opportunities. But yeah, we got some studs here. Vance last year killing it, breaking the national record in the 300 hurdles, and then breaking my state record in the 110s. It's pretty special. We got guys even in the 100 that are running 10-4s already. We got some juice in Arizona. It's good to see always progressing upwards. That's what I want as an athlete, and as a former high school athlete here, is for kids to break my records and run faster than me," unquote. And that was the article from the cover page, first page of the sports section, entitled "Records on the Rise for Track and Field in Arizona." Now, from inside the sports section, we've got an article about D-backs by Jose M. Romero for the Arizona Republic. It's entitled, "D-backs Look Ahead. D-backs Welcome Mets and Dodgers to Chase Field." The Arizona Diamondbacks opened the week of May 4th without right-handed reliever Justin Martinez, who was placed on the 15-day injured list on May 1st with right shoulder inflammation, but have Ketel Marte back from the injured list as Arizona closes its road trip in Philadelphia. Marte missed almost a month with a hamstring injury. Left-handed pitcher Eduardo Rodriguez, who is 1-3, looks to bounce back from a rough outing against the Mets and get himself right in the May 4th series finale with the Phillies. After the game, the Diamondbacks return home to open a 3-game series against the Mets, May 5th, 6th, and 7th. It's a big week with 2 of Major League Baseball's best teams coming to Chase Field. When the Mets leave after the May 7th game, the Los Angeles Dodgers are in town for 4 games, May 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th. The Mets had won 10 of 12 games going into their series with the Diamondbacks on April 29th through the 1st. Arizona cooled them off a little by taking 2 of the 3 games at Citi Field, but New York has hit and pitched well all season. The Mets' starting pitchers all had sub-.310 earned run averages going into play on May 2nd. The Diamondbacks saw left-hander David Peterson in an 8-3 loss on April 29th and right-hander Kodai Senga on May 1st. Now, the Dodgers and Diamondbacks meet for the first time this season. Fans should keep an eye out for the possible unveiling and wearing of the Diamondbacks' new Nike City Connect jerseys during this series. The Dodgers have been hit hard with injuries to their pitching staff, as Blake Snell and Tyler Glasnow, who are 2 key starters, are on the injured list. Blake Treinen, one of LA's top relievers, is also out. But the Dodgers could get one of their stars of their 2024 World Series championship run, reliever Michael Kopech. He could come back from the IL list before the Diamondbacks series. The offense, of course, is loaded with formidable, highly paid hitters. The lineup includes the reigning NL Most Valuable Player, Shohei Ohtani. Then there's Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman and Teoscar Hernandez. The series will feature a salute to Mexican heritage with a free concert from La Original Banda El Limon after the May 9th game. And that was the article, "Diamondbacks Welcome Mets and Dodgers to Chase Field," written by Jose M. Romero for the Arizona Republic. Well, we have time for an abbreviated article entitled "Thrills on Tap as Cup Series Visits Texas." This is by Field Level Media. There were plenty of numbers to come out of Austin Cindric's victory last weekend at Talladega, But it was another Sunday when NASCAR felt it had to defend the quality of its Super Speedway product. NASCAR Senior Vice President of Competition, Elton Sawyer, did so about the race after it concluded, with Cendric recording his third career win, despite a radioed rant of harsh criticism of him by Team Penske teammate Joey Logano, who was later disqualified. Sawyer said, "You look at the stats after the race, and you have 67 lead changes among 23 different drivers. When we look at all of that, what are we trying to fix? What's not going the way we would like it?" Unquote. Well, for starters, real passing. Maybe that will be different this Sunday at Texas Motor Speedway when it hosts its 45th NASCAR Cup Series event, the Wirth 400. Numbers at Talladega and sister track Daytona can be a little misleading when it comes to leaders and lead changes that take place in a two-wide pack, with one driver at the front leading one lap by 2 feet and then sliding back 3 feet for a lead change to the driver beside him. Sunday's most frequent leader at Talladega was Anthony Alfredo, who led a race high 7 times for 19 laps for non-chartered, family-owned Beard Motorsports. In a front-row tug-of-war of inches, Cendric topped the field 5 times for 7 laps over the final 17 circuits, while fellow Row 1 occupant Ryan Preece, also later disqualified, led 4 times for 6 laps. However, it was all too wide racing to the end after Cendric, running 25th, emerged with the lead due to a swift 3-second-plus final pit stop. The problem that the next-gen car is experiencing at the two giant tracks may be the disparity in speed. Very few drivers are likely to step out of a 12-row-deep, 2-wide lane into an open one just to hope someone comes along, else they could suffer a nearly 20-mile-per-hour fall-off in speed and head to the back of the pack. So what is ahead at Texas Motor Speedway? In last season's lone stop in the Lone Star State on an oval, Hendrick Motorsports' Chase Elliott won for the first time in 42 starts by prevailing in 3 late restarts to earn a double overtime thriller over Brad Keselowski in a wildly popular race. The racing was tight in Elliott's first victory since Talladega in October of 22, when he hoisted the trophy in a playoff race win. The scheduled 276-lap event, last year's went 276, it featured a track record 16 cautions, 13 different leaders, and it took 33.5 hours to finish. Fellow Hendrick driver Kyle Larson started from the pole for the third consecutive race and appeared to have the best car after leading a race-high 77 laps, but the right rear tire on his number 5 Chevrolet fell off during a caution period. The only multiple winning drivers at TMS are Kyle Busch with 4 wins and Denny Hamlin with 3. And that's thrills on tap as Cup Series visits Texas. We're coming up on 34 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the viewpoint section and read some opinions. Our first opinion piece is written by E.J. Montini. It's entitled, 10 Commandments Would Be Cut to 5 Under a Pope Donald. When he was asked which Roman Catholic cardinal he would like to become the new pope, Donald Trump answered, "I'd like to be pope. That'd be my number one choice." Well, this makes perfect sense, since Pope Donald could take a chisel to the old stone tablets. Although the first thing Pope Donald would do is not give himself a pope name, which is something the new pontiffs do, usually to honor a previous pope or a saint. There's no one Trump admires more than Trump. And the second thing he'd do is order Elon Musk and the computer bros with the Department of Government Efficiency to trim Catholic bureaucracy by eliminating any of the 250 cardinals who did not vote for Pope Donald, and all of the bishops not located in red states, or Russia, or our south-of-the-border gulag pals in El Salvador. Next, and most important, Pope Donald would order Musk to trim at least half of those pesky Ten Commandments. The first to go, I would guess, would be number one, with its admonition against worshiping false gods. That one already makes sinners of everyone in MAGA, all of Trump's cabinet, all of the Republicans in Congress, and Trump himself when he looks in the mirror. And then there's the number three, the one about keeping the Sabbath. There's a one-word reason why that one must be eliminated: golf. Elon and the boys will also have to cut number seven with its thou shalt not commit adultery command. Otherwise, you know, the new pope would be on the hook for cheating on his first wife with the woman who would become his second wife, and then getting busted by a jury over a payoff meant to cover up an affair with a porn star. Number eight's also a problem, that non-stealing commandment, particularly since Pope Donald already has been fined $364 million and found guilty by a judge of a multi-year scheme to dupe banks by inflating his worth. Commandment number nine really must go as well. That's the one about lying. Remember how the fact-checkers at the Washington Post last time around kept track of the untruths that Trump told and found that he averaged 21 per day? That's a whopping 30,573 violations of number nine during his first term. Well, of course, these reductions in the number of commandments, streamlining the pontiff would call them, would most likely constitute only the first round of cuts. I mean, a holy father who already sells nearly 170 products with his name or image on them, ranging from sneakers to coins to luxury watches to, yes, Bibles. Well, he's definitely going to want to eliminate the ban on graven images in commandment number two. And then there's number 10. If the new pope already owns a resort in Florida, some hotels and golf resorts, and he gets to live in the White House, yet he still wants to crash occasionally at the Vatican and ride around in the Popemobile, do you think he would let stand a biblical prohibition on coveting? And that was E.J. Montini's article, 10 Commandments Would Be Cut to 5 Under a Pope Donald. Our next opinion piece is by Phil Boas, who's a columnist for the Arizona Republic. It's time to get more aggressive on homeless camps. By the sounds of it, Maricopa County supervisors are tiptoeing into a delicate issue. First came the meeting agenda that revealed they would discuss a ban on homeless encampments in a closed-door executive session. Then, Supervisor Tom Galvin acknowledged his interest in the topic, but told the Arizona Republic's Sasha Hupka that he wasn't ready to offer details. Quote, I don't have much to say. It's kind of like, hey, let's just talk about that. Let's just get some legal advice, unquote. Well, okay, it never hurts to proceed with caution, but this issue has come a long way in a few short years. Clearing homeless encampments enjoys enormous national support. Not only does the county have the popular wind at its back, it has the force of law from the Arizona Superior Court clear up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Last year, Arizona voters spoke with passage of Proposition 312, which allows residents to request property tax refunds when cities, towns, and counties fail to enforce public nuisance laws, including those for illegal camping, loitering, and panhandling. American attitudes have hardened against the rapidly multiplying homeless camps that have spiraled like vines across our largest cities, including Metro Phoenix. The encampments are a sign of social decay and breakdown of law and order. Cleanup is not only an imperative, but a bipartisan one. If the quiet discussions in Maricopa County express an impulse to more aggressively confront the problem, our supervisors are in good standing. Much of America and Arizona are moving in that direction, not just the red parts. Politico reported on April 18th that one of the most progressive states in our country, the neighbor to the west, is fed up with the problem. The political headline cried, quote, California's frustration with homelessness is boiling over, unquote. Nearly 40% of the people in that politically progressive state are ready to take more strident action against the new urban campers. Political report this, quote, California voters have grown so frustrated with the blue state's failure to reduce homelessness that well over a third of the electorate now support local laws that allow police to arrest people camping outside if they refuse shelter, unquote. Now, that isn't to argue that Arizona law enforcement should go charging into tent cities with badges and handcuffs. The issue demands firmness and grace. America may have been built by rugged individualists, but most of us feel sympathy for people who have fallen on their luck. In the case of today's homeless people, many are drug addicted and mentally ill and incapable of living healthy lives without intervention. They need our help. Our attitudes on poverty and homelessness were shaped in the public schools by classics such as John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath and Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. Those works express all too graphically the homelessness of people when society turns its back. But lately, our societies have grown too permissive with homeless people. We have extended them so much freedom that they have turned our city sidewalks into tent cities, festering with drug use, prostitution, and disease. The Atlantic reported in 2019 that urban encampments infested with rats and insects had become fertile ground for medieval diseases. Here's how the magazine described it back then. Quote, Los Angeles recently experienced an outbreak of typhus, a disease spread by infected fleas on rats and other animals in downtown streets. Officials briefly closed part of City Hall after reporting that rodents had invaded the building, unquote. Well, that compelled California's liberal governor, Gavin Newsom, to say with disbelief, quote, typhus, a medieval disease in California in 2019, unquote. So acute was the problem that since then, California has spent roughly $24 billion. That's about $160,000 per homeless person to tackle the encampments in a soft, progressive way. Well, what's the result? Well, Stanford University's Hoover Institution reported, quote, in this five-year period, homelessness increased by about 30,000 to now more than 181,000, unquote. Well, now Californians are ready to get tough. The metropolitan city, such as Los Angeles or Phoenix, is an extraordinary invention of man that brings the masses together to share ideas, to grow business, to build markets, and to raise prosperity. But when neglected, however, they become a mass of teeming pathologies that repel commerce and clean living. And we have begun to cross that line in many of our major cities over the last decade. American cities have turned shabby, and it is a reflection on the Democratic Party that manages much of America's urban core. In Phoenix, people living and working in and around the zone, that's the area that had become the largest encampment in Arizona, they sued the city and forced the 2023 cleanup of the area between 7th and 15th Avenues and Van Buren and Grant Streets. But such sweeps don't solve the homeless problem. They merely disperse it. In March, the Republic's Katherine Rager reported that the homeless problem has grown more acute in other parts of the city, including popular historic districts. Homeless individuals bring drug use and defecation and fire starting to these neighborhoods and compel homeowners to move. The problem has begun to show up in the data as home values fall in these affected neighborhoods. Our county supervisors recognize the problem, and most promised during their own elections to work to solve the housing shortage and the homeless problem in Maricopa County. As they continue in that direction, the people of this county should let them know that we have their backs. And that was Phil Boaz's article, It's Time to Get More Aggressive on Homeless Camps. Well, we're coming up on 45 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the entertainment section of the paper and begin with reading today's horoscopes. So we will begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Has a friendship run its course? Pluto goes retrograde today, foreshadowing the cutting of cords. For Taurus, birthdays from April 20th to May 20th, acquiring true power lies in acknowledging your thirst for it. For Geminis, birthdays from May 21st to June 21st, beliefs that you have bought into unconsciously are revealed. Empower yourself by changing your mind. For Cancer, birthdates from June 22nd through July 22nd, how many of your decisions are fueled by fear? You are awakened to your power. For Leos, birthdates from July 23rd through August 22nd, how's your love life? Revelations will transform how you do relationships. For you fellow Virgos out there, birthdates from August 23rd through September 22nd, the next 5 months hammer home the futility of bad habits. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birthdates, caution against hedonistic behavior. Dangerous risk deliver blowback. Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birthdates, are you in control of your emotions, or are your emotions controlling you? You get a wake-up call. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birthdates, you won't get the right answers without asking the right questions. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birthdates, your power lies in your resources. Pluto's retrograde helps you separate the wheat from the chaff. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birthdates, you question who you think you are. And finally, Pisces, birthdates from February 19th to March 20th. Pluto's five-month retrograde functions as a form of psychic surgery. And those were today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren in her column, Dear Abby. The first letter goes, Dear Abby, ever since I was a child, my mom has regarded me as wise, thoughtful, and intelligent. She has confided about family issues, tensions at church, and cheating at her workplace. Abby, I don't want to be her confidant. Am I doomed to always hear her never-ending problems? She creates them herself by jumping to conclusions and suspecting everyone has ill intentions. While I understand this is to protect herself, it's exhausting to listen to and to advise when I know nothing will change. The worst part is, I cannot confide in her. She doesn't understand my perspective. I don't think she even tries. Our relationship is one-sided. Sometimes I feel like I'm her mom. She talks to no one else like this and refuses to go to therapy. I'm a senior in high school and plan to go to college. I don't want to leave her like this. How can I help her? Signed, Captive Confident in Iowa. Dear Captive Confident, the best chance you have of helping your emotionally dependent mother would be to start by helping yourself. Begin making plans about where you will go to college, creating plenty of physical space between you and mom. The next time she starts to confide, tell her you don't have time to listen and that she should discuss it with a contemporary who has more life experience than you, because that's the truth. She won't like hearing it, and she may try to make you feel guilty. But don't fall for it. Keep repeating to your mother that her problems are more than you can handle, and that talking to you about them hasn't helped her, which is why you want her to talk with a licensed mental health professional. That would be the best way to help your mother. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, I have a disagreement with my fiancé. Fran has been a widow for nearly 6 years. I have been divorced for 34 years from a woman who gave me 2 sons. Fran also has a son and a daughter who lives nearby. We've been dating for 4 years. She has her own place, and I have mine, but we live less than 2 miles apart. Our disagreement is about two portraits of her late husband, and she has hanging in her home, in plain sight for everyone who comes into the house to see. I have asked her to remove them, but she refuses. In order to see her reaction, I put my wedding photos with my ex-wife on display. When Fran saw them, she hit the roof and demanded that I take them down. I told her no, since she refuses to give her son and daughter her portraits. Can you provide us with any advice? Signed, Picturing a Problem in Florida. And Abby responds, Dear Picturing, grow up. Fran's husband is dead, gone, and not a threat to your relationship. He is, however, part of her history. And if you can't accept that, it's time to deal with your insecurities. Retaliating by hanging pictures from a marriage that didn't make it to the finish line 34 years ago was petty. And those were the letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. It's 51 minutes past the hour, so we're going to take a look at some comics. In the comic strip Zits, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borkman, in the first frame, we hear the door slam, and Mom's got a bowl that looks like she's of salad, and she says, Hi, Jeremy, how was your day? In the next frame, he throws his backpack down on the table and says, I don't want to talk about it. In the next frame, he picks his backpack up and starts emptying it out. Papers and books are falling out of it. He says, I have homework in every single class. And then in the next frame, he grabs something off the table from dinner and he's eating it and saying, Not only that, we had a fire drill in the freezing rain and my zipper broke. And the next frame, plus Sarah's acting all weird because of who knows what, peers, blah, blah. And then we can't read the rest of it because it's all jumbled up letters. And Jeremy, so it's all stuff that Jeremy's saying. And over at the kitchen table, Dad says, What's going on? And Mom says, Jeremy's not talking about his day. And that was Zits. And in the comic strip, Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, in the first frame, General Halftrack's in his office, and Lieutenant Fuzz stands at the door and says, Sorry to bother you, sir, but I feel it's important. And General Halftrack says, It had better be. In the next frame, he says, Sir, I have a problem. The men don't respect me. I've tried being friendly and even mean, but neither worked. I've tried different uniforms. I've lowered the tone of my voice. I've raised the volume. No change. I wonder if you have any advice. How do you do it? And then the last frame, the general says, Do you think I get any respect? And that was Beetle Bailey. In the comic strip Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, Dag was at the front door, and the little kid, I think it's Elmo, from the neighborhood, is standing there and says, Mr. B., I've been ringing your doorbell, but I guess it wasn't loud enough. And Dagwood says, It's because I've been trying to get some nap time on the sofa. And the next frame, the little kid says, That's exactly what I figured, and it gave me a great idea. We need to come up with a secret ring sound so you'll always know when it's me. And Dagwood says, I don't think so, Elmo. And then the next frame, Elmo says, Well, if I had my own key, I could let myself in and never disturb your nap time. And Dagwood says, Nope, that wouldn't work either. Why not, Mr. B? And Dagwood says, I can't fall asleep if I know that someone might be watching me. So in the last frame, Dagwood's gone back in the house, the door's closed, and Elmo turns to walk away and says, Mr. B sure has some nutty ideas when it comes to naps. And that was Blondie. In the comic strip Pickles, drawn by Brian Crane, in the first frame, Earl is sitting in his easy chair, feet up on the ottoman, and Pickles comes in and goes, Earl, and he sighs. She says, What's wrong? You look a little down. And he says, You ever have one of those days when everyone seems to dislike you? And she says, Is that how you feel? And he goes, Sort of. And she says, Well, I really doubt that everyone dislikes you. I mean, there are tons of people who never even met you. And that was Pickles. And in Peanuts, drawn by Charles Schulz, in the first frame, Charlie Brown looks at a calendar and says, oh, May 14th, I knew it. The next frame, he's out at Snoopy's doghouse, and he says, next Sunday is Mother's Day. And Snoopy thinks, it is? And Charlie Brown says, you should give your mother a call. Or at least write her a letter. It should be a very personal letter. The kind that could only come from you. And so in the last frame, Snoopy's on top of his doghouse at his typewriter, and he types, Dear Mom, and the O in Mom is a paw print. And that was Peanuts. Well, before we go, we ought to wish happy birthday to some celebrities who are celebrating today. Congratulations to bassist Ron Carter. He worked with the Miles Davis Quintet. He turns 88 today. Journalist and pundit George Will turns 84. Singer Jackie Jackson turns 74. Actress and singer Pia Zadora turns 71. Singer and guitarist Randy Travis turns 66. Actress and comedian Anna Gasteyer turns 58. Actor and comedian Will Arnett turns 55. Fashion model designer Kimora Lee Simmons turns 50. Sportscaster Aaron Andrews turns 47 today. And singer Lance Bass turns 46. Happy birthday and congratulations to these celebrities. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to this second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 4th, 2025. Have a great day today. Bye-bye.